This week on Capitalism, Race, and Democracy.
How do we really help to quote unquote rehabilitate people? What are the services? What are the care interventions that we need so that no one has to be in a cage? That type of thinking comes out of our prisons, and this is what Black August is about.
The legacy of Black freedom struggles lives on. We'll hear from Monifa Bandali of the Policy Table Leadership Team at the Movement for Black Lives.
Black August is very significant to uphold the names of political prisoners and get people to know who they are, to support them, and to develop the demand to free each and every last one of them.
Jihad Abdul-Mumit of the Jericho Movement in conversation with the late Glenn Ford.
Nowhere in the world do freedom and justice-loving people struggling against oppression forget their freedom fighters, forget their political prisoners. We must stand up for our political prisoners and prisoners of war and demand their release. We have a responsibility not to forget those who fought for us. We owe that to them and their families because they sacrificed so much for us.
Sekou Odinga makes the call to free all political prisoners. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Akua Holt.
August, a month of injustice and divine justice, of repression and righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. August saw slaves and the grandsons of slaves strike out for their God-given right to freedom, as well as the awesome price, the ultimate price, always paid by those who would dare oppose the slave master's will. Like their spiritual grandfather, the blessed rebel Nat Turner, those who oppose Massa in this land of unfreedom met murder by the state. George and Jonathan Jackson, James McLean, William Christmas, Bobby Hutton, Steve Bartholomew, Robert Lawrence, Tommy Lewis, Sylvester Bell, all suffered the fate of Nat Turner, of the slave daring to fight the slave master for his freedom.
That was journalist, author, and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, reflecting on the legacy of Black August. We'll hear more from Mumia later on in the show. Nina Simone, Baltimore. 60 years ago, on Saturday, August 28, 1963, the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, led by Dr. Martin Luther King and others, was notably the largest demonstration in the U.S., with more than 250,000 people in attendance. Pennell E. Joseph wrote a CNN opinion piece stating, quote, "No major civil rights legislation passed in 1963, but it was the most important year in the decade that transformed America, which included voices from all backgrounds." Unquote. The Civil Rights Bill was passed by Congress on July 2, 1964, and later signed by President Johnson the same day. The bill was initially proposed in June 1963 by President John F. Kennedy, stating it was moral, constitutional, and legal to guarantee equal access to public facilities, education, and to provide federal protection of the right to vote. Kennedy was assassinated that same year in Dallas, Texas, November 22, 1963, by bullets of hate. There were fearless Black women who helped to organize the march, including Daisy Bates, journalist and advisor to the Little Rock Nine. She was asked to fill in for Merle Evers, who had been delayed due to heavy traffic. Here's a clip of Miss Daisy Bates.
Mr. Randolph, friend, the women of this country, Mr. Randolph, pledge to you, to Martin Luther King, Roy Wilkins, and all of you fighting for civil liberties, that we will join hands with you as women of this country. Rosa Gregg, my president, Dorothy Height, the National Council of Negro Women, the Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, the Methodist Church women, all the women, pledge that we will join hands with you. We will kneel in, we will sit in until we can eat in any counter in the United States. We will walk until we are free, until we can walk to any school and take our children to any school in the United States. And we will sit in and we will kneel in and we will lie in if necessary until every Negro in America can vote. This we pledge to the women of America.
That was Daisy Bates, the only woman who spoke at the March on Washington in 1963. Bates and her husband were important voices in Little Rock. They were publishers of the Arkansas State Press, which reported violations of the Supreme Court's desegregation rulings.
No taxation without representation. 200 years of exploitation in the capital of this nation. No representation in the capital of this nation. 200 years of exploitation. Give the people their right to vote.
Sweet Honey in the Rock, give the people the right to vote. Today, the fight continues to protect the right to vote. Nationwide, after the Supreme Court struck down Section 4B of the Voting Rights Act in Shelby v. Holder on June 25, 2013, leaving the power in the hands of southern states to determine voting maps without federal oversight. That decision has led to voter disenfranchisement today. Last Saturday, August 26, the King family, Reverend Al Sharpton's Action Network, labor leaders, activists, politicians, entertainers, and a host of organizations spoke at the 60th March on Washington commemoration held at the Lincoln Memorial. Former mayor, congressman, and ambassador Andrew Young, who's 91, reportedly one of the last civil rights leaders of his era, said, "The ballot is the passport to freedom and opportunity." Reverend Al Sharpton reminded the crowd that the movement must continue, and quote, "No matter how hard you make it, we're coming anyhow," unquote, stating that our fathers fought for this right to vote and we're going to maintain it. Last poets, blessed are those who struggle. Another struggle for self-determination led by young black activists was evolving during this era of transformation in the U.S. Monica Moorhead, managing editor of the Workers' World, says, quote, Black August played a significant role in the political development and activism for many revolutionaries and activists of her generation, unquote. In an excerpt published on Black August, August 19, 2023, Moorhead said she graduated from high school in Virginia when Jonathan Jackson, 17 at the time, attempted to free his brother, George Jackson, an imprisoned leader of the Black Panther Party, Rochelle McGee, another political prisoner who was released this year after 67 years of imprisonment, and others, in a Marin County courtroom in San Rafael, California, on August 7, 1970. Munifa Bandeli, member of the policy table leadership team at the Movement for Black Lives, joins Mark Lamont Hill of Black News Tonight to share more insight about the commemoration of Black August.
On August 21st, 1971, Black Panther George Jackson was shot and killed as he allegedly attempted to escape from the infamous San Quentin State Prison. 10 years earlier, in 1961, at the age of 18, for stealing $70 from a gas station, he was sentenced 1 year to life in prison. According to his judge, that indeterminate sentence was to incentivize a so-called good behavior from Jackson. While he was in prison, he displayed anything but that so-called good behavior that the judge wanted. Instead, he fought for freedom. He was appointed as a field marshal by the Oakland chapter of the Black Panther Party, and he recruited other incarcerated people. He organized sit-ins against segregated cafeterias, and he taught martial arts. C.L.R. James, the great Trinidadian author of Black Jacobins, called George Jackson's writings in Soledad Brother, quote, the most remarkable political documents that have appeared inside or outside the United States since the death of Lenin. Since 1979, Black August has been commemorated to remember George Jackson, as well as to honor all political prisoners and celebrate Black resistance across the United States. Joining me now is Munifa Bandeli. She's a member of the policy table leadership team at the Movement for Black Lives. Munifa, good to see you as always. Talk to me about Black August and what it means.
Thank you so much for having me. I mean, Black August is so important to all of us today that are part of the Movement for Black Lives and just the larger Black liberation struggle today, because it connects us to our roots. You talked about it. George Jackson was killed in August of 1971. And for nearly a decade, his comrades and people who were incarcerated around the country commemorated his death, studied those writings that you talked about, educated themselves and their families towards Black liberation. And what they found was that August had a deep history of Black rebellions and resistance. You had the Nat Turner rebellions happened in August. The Watts uprisings happened in August. The Gabriel Prosser rebellions happened in August. The Underground Railroad started in August. And so these scholars behind the walls began to piece together a commemoration month that would honor George Jackson, but also Katari Golden, who had helped build the study around Black August, and so many other fallen freedom fighters, George Jackson's brother, Jonathan Jackson. So in 1979, this became a celebration that went throughout the entire California prison system. And by 1980, it became a national commemoration. And it allowed people to really take that time, reflect, to study, to struggle, to make a plan of action. I think the most important thing people can know about Black August is it's not just not another Black History Month. This is not about celebrating people who we necessarily look up to or are palatable to the larger society. This is specifically about us celebrating our resistors and our incarcerated freedom fighters.
I love the language that the great scholar Robin Kelly gives us, love, study, struggle. Because for me, that's what Black August is about, exhibiting a profound love and generating a profound love for our people and for freedom. Study, as you said, reading deeply and carefully, and then of course struggling, being committed to getting into the fray in some form to resist. I think that's so important. When you think about, I want to start with that love piece of it. when we think about what it means to love Black folk and to Black and to love Black freedom or just freedom in general, how does that resonate? How does that idea resonate with you?
You know, it's powerful. One of the most powerful elements of Black August is that when it started in the prison system, throughout the month of August, prisoners displayed the highest levels of love and discipline and solidarity. Mm. It was actually frightening to the prison guards. You could hear a pin drop during meals, you know, out in the yard, where typically what we're taught when we look at, you know, television and the media that, you know, prisoners are constantly being violent with one another, fighting, you know, all of that paused for August as the leaders in those prisons modeled how we should treat one another and relate to one another behind the walls. And then that grew outside of the walls, right? Because people went home and they interacted with their families, and they're like, I experienced this powerful month where we as people who society has cast away displayed love to one another. We read together. They had their reading of book clubs during the month of August. And we can do this outside of the walls. So that is what really resonates with us. We picked it up in the Malcolm X grassroots movement, which is a member of the Movement for Black Lives, decades later in the early 2000s. You know, we launched a Black August hip hop project to bring in a new generation to study about Black August and also to model that love. The idea that no one in our community is disposable. We're taught that people who are in prison, people who are incarcerated in jails and detention centers are people we shouldn't think about their human rights. We shouldn't think about them at all. And yet here they are, the intellectual architects of one of the most profound commemorations that we have, because it ties us back to our Black liberation roots beyond what they'll teach us in school.
And that's why I like that second piece of its study, because not only are we reading about our history, not only are we reading about struggle, but we're specifically reading, at least in my tradition, in my experience, the writings of the great prison intellectuals. So we're reading Soledad Brother by George Jackson. We're reading, Live from Death Row by Mumia Abu-Jamal. We're reading Asada. You know, we're learning, as you pointed out, that some of the most brilliant minds, some of the most great political thinkers that we've ever had were caged, and they still have so much to offer, not just before they got in and after they got out, but while they were in. I think that's so important. Before we go, though, there's this third piece of struggle I want you to help me think through right now. What should we be struggling against? What should we be struggling for?
You know, one of the prisoners who we talk about often is Dr. Mutulu Shakur, who's the stepfather of Tupac Shakur. Mm. He has a saying, dare to struggle, dare to win. Dare to struggle, dare to win. Anytime you read one of Mutulu's writings, you will see that. And essentially what he is saying is that, you know, faith without works is dead, right? We have got to struggle for the things that we want, not only for our families, but for our community, for the global Black world, right? And we have to step into that with power. And if they can talk like that, if they can write those things and give those types of instructions from behind the walls, then we can do it outside. And it continues. Not only do we commemorate them, not only do we make sure that their work and their intellectual work and their freedom fighting work is visible, we have to move into prison abolition, because we know that they shouldn't be caged and we shouldn't have cages. You know, this idea of abolition really grows out of a long tradition. Some people are just hearing about it now, but it is many of these intellectuals from behind the walls that have talked about, how do we really make our communities safe? How do we really help to quote unquote rehabilitate people? What are the services? What are the care interventions that we need so that no one has to be in a cage? That type of thinking comes out of our prisons, and this is what Black August is about.
That is what Black August is all about. Love, study, and struggle. Monifa, thank you so much for joining me, and happy Black August.
That was Mark Lamont Hill of Black News Tonight and Munifa Bandeli, member of the Policy Table Leadership Team at the Movement for Black Lives, discussing Black August commemoration. At 84 years of age, former political prisoner Rochelle McGee is the only survivor of the August 7, 1970 shooting in Marin County. On July 21st, 2023, after 67 years of imprisonment, the Coalition to Free Rochelle McGee announced that he had finally won his release. McGee has maintained he was unjustly incarcerated for decades. He argues that slavery for many has not ended, especially for black prisoners facing a parole process that insists on the admission of guilt and responsibility prior to any consideration of release from incarceration. George Jackson, Soledad Brother. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Sekou Odinga was a leading member of the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army during the 1960s in prison for over 33 years for fighting for the freedom of black people and the building of the Republic of New Africa. Odinga is one of almost two dozen members of the Black Panther Party who have spent 30 years or more unjustly held in the U.S. prison system as political prisoners. In 2017, he spoke on FRED, Facing Race Elevating Democracy Talks, which is part of Race Forward's Mass Freedom Project.
My name is Sekou Odinga, and I am a former member of the Black Panther Party and a former political prisoner of war. I was released on parole on November 25th, 2014, after serving 33 years in prison. Today, I want to speak a little more about political prisoners in the U.S. What or who is a political prisoner? A political prisoner is someone arrested and convicted for their political activity, their political thoughts, ideas, words, or support. You might be thinking, no one becomes a political prisoner in the U.S. The truth is, anyone organizing or struggling for their people can become a target for political imprisonment if the powers that be consider them a threat. An example of this is Assata Shakur. Another example is Sundiata Okoli. Both were members of the Black Panther Party who got up 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning to feed school children before they went to school. Sometimes it was the only good meal they had all day. Both worked to help welfare mothers get the assistance they were entitled. Both worked on community housing, political education, and health programs. Assata is a graduate of BMCC CUNY, and before joining the Black Panther Party, she worked in a hospital. Sundiata is a mathematician who worked at NASA, helping to teach math to future astronauts. Assata has been living in exile in Cuba for almost 40 years and is admired as a legendary freedom fighter in social justice movements around the world. Sundiata is 80 years old and continues to be held in a federal prison facility and has been denied parole numerous times. Political prisoners were targeted by COINTELPRO, the FBI's counterintelligence program that worked with local police to monitor, infiltrate, attack, and in some cases, kill activists. Fred Hampton and Mark Clark from Chicago are such examples. Hampton was the chairman of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party. In 1969, the Chicago Police Department sent an informant agent into Fred's home to drug him. Then the police, along with the FBI, came and shot up the house, murdering Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in their sleep. These are established facts revealed in the lawsuit the family won against the city of Chicago, Cook County, and the federal government. Today, COINTELPRO continues under Homeland Security, the Patriot Act, and national security agencies, etc., whereby activists are still targeted, monitored, and entrapped. Recently, the FBI's Counterterrorism Division has declared, quote, black identity extremists as threats, end quote, which can include anyone fighting to protect black lives. Like many of you, our political prisoners were young activists when they got involved with the struggle for the survival and freedom of their people. All our political prisoners continue to be concerned and involved in what's going on in our communities. Of course, the U.S. government has claimed and continue to claim that the United States has no political prisoners, but that's clearly a lie. All freedom struggles against oppressive governments produce political prisoners. This is a historical fact. We can go back as far as Jesus Christ, peace be upon him, who was himself a political prisoner of the Roman Empire. Just as Leonard Peltier, Afia Siddiqui, and 13 members of the Black Panther Party are political prisoners of the U.S. Empire. Our political prisoners are sentenced to long, indeterminate sentences, with most serving up to and more than 30 to 50 years in prison. It is the state's intent to take these political prisoners who would dare to struggle away from the masses and lock them up for decades to keep their revolutionary example hidden. I think it is important for people to know that political prisoners are part of movements. They do not exist in a vacuum. Political prisoners come from the American Indian Movement, the Black Liberation Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, the White Anti-Imperialist Movement, and every other movement for human rights. These movements have been criminalized by the United States. This means we have a stake in knowing and supporting political prisoners. If we don't, how can we expect our youth to join in the struggle to make the world a better place if they know that they will probably be forgotten if arrested and imprisoned for struggling? Let's all become educated and stand up for our political prisoners. Visit the JerichoMovement.com for addresses to write political prisoners. And if you can, send money. Join Jericho. Join the Northeast Political Prisoner Coalition and or other political prisoner support committees. Challenge the myth that political prisoners and prisoners of war don't exist in the U.S. among your friends and networks, and call for the release and freedom of political prisoners and prisoners of war. Nowhere in the world do freedom and justice-loving people struggling against oppression forget their freedom fighters, forget their political prisoners. We must stand up for our political prisoners and prisoners of war and demand their release. We need their strength, knowledge, and commitment out here working with us to make this a better world. We have a responsibility not to forget those who fought for us. We owe that to them and their families because they sacrificed so much for us. That's the least we can do for them. Let's free all our political prisoners and prisoners of war. Freedom of all. Thank you.
We just heard from former political prisoner Sekou Odinga.
One of these days, things ain't gonna change. today. Things gonna change. Your time now, baby. After a while, gonna do mine, gonna be mine. One of these days, baby, I'm mourning, droning, baby. Try, try, won't be long, long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing gonna change, thing gonna change. Change, change, change. Thing gonna change. Further on up the road, baby, thing gonna change, 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 change.
The legendary John Lee Hooker, featuring Carlos Santana on his album Chill Out, recorded in 1995. Jihad Abdul-Mumit is chair of the Jericho Movement and a former Black Panther political prisoner who spent 23 years behind bars. In August of 2020, he spoke to the late Glenn Ford of the Black Agenda Report about the origins and importance of Black August.
Black August was started in San Quentin with George Jackson and those comrades there to highlight the armed struggles, to be very blunt, the history of those struggles in and around this country. And there's a lot of events that happened throughout time. I'm here in Richmond, even Gable Proffer in 1800, Nat Turner in 1832. There's a lot of things that happened, a lot of birthdays, a lot of significant events. And so what Jericho attempts to do, as many other sisters and brothers throughout the United States attempt to do, is to utilize this month on the personal note to collectively draw strength. We fast, we work out, we study, we do good deeds, we check in with one another. Not that we shouldn't be doing this at any other time, but we really accentuate that during the month of Black August. For the public is concerned, we educate people, we try to organize events so that people can become in tune with what it means for self-determination in those type of struggles, and not to be afraid of that, to recognize the political reality that we're in the United States of America, and these struggles that have in the past are reflective of the conditions that protesters in the street are still fighting. Police violence, racism, and then even further health disparities, marginalization, impoverishment of our communities. And so, yeah, so Black August is very significant to uphold the names of political prisoners and get people to know who they are, to support them, and to develop the demand to free each and every last one of them.
On a fundamental level, it's a struggle just to get people to understand that there are political prisoners in the United States. Jericho maintains a list of political prisoners. Most of them are from the Black Panther Party and the Black Liberation Army, but there are also prisoners on your list who still languish in jail from the Republic of New Africa and from lots of different kinds of movements. There are anarchists on your list. There are anti-imperialists on your list. And other examples of people who have been put in prison because of their political activities. But the government continues to maintain that it doesn't have any political prisoners and never has.
Right, indeed. And this is just to show you how effective the brainwashing and indoctrination is. Even in talking about our institutions, the remission or the lack of mentioning in context that young children, teenagers, adolescents get going through school, college students. A brother, a friend of mine, an attorney now, brother Najee Mujahid, who you may know, Glenn, he was on a talk show with me. Just going to capture what you're saying. even in our institutions, not mentioning and putting in context. This brother, he's a lawyer now in Philadelphia, and I'm so proud of him. He does so much work in helping political prisoners and helping people in the community. And he said that when he was going to law school, one of the cases that they analyzed was the case of Huey P. Newton and the killing of Officer Frey, F-R-E-Y. And he said when his law class dissected this case, the instructor never mentioned, and there was no context whatsoever, that he was even in the Panther Party and the social political ramifications surrounding this case. They only mentioned the technical law points. So even students that were going through that class that didn't know about the Panther Party or who actually Huey P. Newton was, it was just an individual charged with murdering a cop, and here's how the arraignment process went and the bail process and this and that. So even in these institutions of learning, it's just not by mentioning, by omission, let alone the blatant lies. So I guess the point I'm making is that people are so ignorant and they're so invested in chasing the carrot in this materialist society. It has an egregious effect on a lot of us. And, you know, the whole seems like it's counterintuitive. The whole effort is to make better your welfare and your existence in this society. But in the process of doing that, you sell your own soul because, you know, the United States has become what it is, as Al-Hajj Malik El-Sabah said, on the back of slaves, the blood of slaves. And we, myself included, brother Jeremy, if I can talk about my car and my rental home and my yard and my house, is really we enjoy these benefits by the continued exploitation of world resources and imperialism, and we have no idea the impact of our ignorance. We have to argue and beg black activists, black academics, black people to recognize that we have freedom fighters. Yeah, I mean, we're in the age, Glenn, where we have cell phones, we can Google anybody's name or anything in a matter of seconds, and we still don't have the context. That just shows how effective this materialist society has been, just having us focus on our individual selves at the expense of our whole community and our very existence. The propaganda is very effective. There are no political prisoners in the United States, and people believe it.
Lots of comparisons have been made between the current movement, which mobilized more numbers by some counts than any previous movement in U.S. history, and the movement of the 60s and the 70s. Well, one thing that stands out as a difference between these two movements is the chants, the slogans. We remember the slogans that mobilized millions: Free Huey, Free Bobby, Free Angela, Free the Wilmington 10, free all kinds of folks who were becoming political prisoners at that time. But today, when we still have scores of that era's political prisoners languishing in jail and new political prisoners having joined those ranks, we don't hear those kinds of chants and slogans about freeing political prisoners.
Right. And no, we don't. And I think that was surgically removed, and people have fallen into that ignorant remission of not mentioning them. And I think the powers that be over a period of time, it just didn't happen overnight, to try to eliminate any vestiges or remnants or memories of those type of struggles, which include armed struggles to really change the structure of society. So now, as militant as the demonstrations and protests are, and I salute what's going on. So don't get me wrong. I salute what's going on. It's not condemning or demeaning or anything like that. It's just the difference is that when we talk about self-determination, when we talk about building a new society, when we talk about separating ourselves from this capitalist madness, it's not quite the same when we're talking about reforming that and making quote-unquote radical adjustments, if you will. Those struggles back then was cutting to the chase. And a lot of it, you know, involved armed struggle if necessary. And somebody listening to this may think that was so futile and idealistic and foolish. You can assess it from 50 years later. But in the heat of that, you know, those demonstrations were even more vicious. You're talking about how when Donald Trump came out to do his Bible stand across from Lafayette Park there, how the police pushed everybody back and sprayed pepper gas. Well, if you go back in 1968, look at some of them demonstrations, or in the 60s, you know, where they had high-power water hoses and flagrantly smashing your brains in. Well, get ready for the fight. But it was much different when you're talking about actually radically changing something. So they don't want that to ever resurface again. And that's another conversation about what that would even look like in this day and age. But it's just making sure that the powers that be and through the institutions, we glorify a certain type of struggle. And we make sure that people don't have any connections or building a socialist government or self-determination for people and going about it the way it was being done then. So it's purposely disconnected. And if you connect political prisoners with that, that's a connection you don't want, because it's going to lead you to the path of realizing this is what was happening then and done. And this may be what has to be happening now and done, albeit different changes to fit the time. So I think it's surgically removed like that. But I just want to draw a parallel, an example. One time in Dick Gregory's book, you probably read it, Tell No Lies or something to that effect, long, long, long time ago. But in there, he had a scenario that the United States in upholding this facade of democracy is like a tea kettle boiling water on the stove. You know, the boiling water is our social and economic and political condition, oppressive conditions, and unrest that goes along with that. And then they put a hole in the top of the tea kettle so it can whistle and steam so that tea kettle doesn't blow. That whistling and steaming is the facade of democracy. Your First Amendment right to demonstrate and protest. See, people can demonstrate and protest not like any other country, fine and good, but it's not really going too much. I mean, there's things that we can talk about that has happened, Civil Rights Bill 63 and all of that type of things like that, which we all enjoy and get benefit from. That is true. But a superpower, a materialist society, industrialized society that we live in today, that whistling at the tea kettle is important to show that there is democracy here, unlike any other quote-unquote country around the world. And if you was to plug that up, that tea kettle will and burn everything in this kitchen, which is revolution. So our ability to protest in the street and throw rocks and burn some property, yeah, that's all part of this society that we live in to maintain the very, very existence of this society. And if you get too much out of range, out of hand, we'll pluck you off and we'll send you to prison for the rest of your life, or we'll blow you away in the street. But for the most part, everybody can protest unlike any other country, and it adds to the facade of democracy because the stuff ain't changing.
That was Jihad Abdul-Mumit of the Jericho Movement speaking to the late Glenn Ford in August of 2020 on Black Agenda Radio. India Irie, Strength, Courage, and Wisdom. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Akua Holt. Here's a commentary by award-winning journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Death row, then and now. It is a daunting task to describe death row, that peculiarly American institution of ultimate exclusion, where men, women were sent to rot, to sit, to die. In the beginning, guys spent 23 and 1, meaning 23 hours in a cell and 1 hour out. After some minor protests and hunger strikes, the regime became 22 hours in a cell and 2 hours outside. that endured for years. And then a United Nations expert, Juan Mendez, the body's special rapporteur on torture, issued an official opinion declaring that any amount of time past 13 days in solitary confinement constituted irreparable damage to the psyche and thus violated international law. Armed with such research, the Abolitionist Law Center of Pittsburgh contacted the state's prison administrators to challenge the lockdown of death row after months of haggling and negotiations. A new reality dawned on death row. Men spent over 6 hours a day out of cell, had contact visits with family and friends, and intermingled with other guys in population. They went to the yards with other men. To many men who spent decades on death row, this new thing became unrecognizable. More importantly, some men gained new trials, and several went home. Over the years, you've no doubt heard me speak of many of them and their walk away from the house of darkness. Quietly, dozens of other cases endured resentencing, so that some received time served and others lesser sentences. And yet, death row remains a weapon. It therefore needs far more than reform. It needs to be abolished. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Death Row, Then and Now, was produced by Prison Radio, an independent multimedia production studio, producing content for radio, television, online streaming, and films for 30 years to globally amplify voices of people most impacted by the prison industrial complex. Visit prisonradio.org to learn more about their work.
Great ancestors, you are breath. You are bridge. You carry us over tumultuous time. You who can hear and answer with quick remedy, you are ready before we ask. You who can speak through tongues of trees and fire and water, this earth cannot hold you. We pound the ground and you appear, O ancient ones. You who can make lightning strike with the flick of a skirt. You who can make tornado turn with the spin and span of hips, take us there to the place of knowing, to the hall that leads to the doorway of you, O holy ones. You of the first light, you who know the potential of possibility, pulsing in the dark, deliver us unto our gifts. You who have sunlight in your fingertips, touch our drums, make us hear the rising, make us move a steady stump, a choir of voices so majestic, heaven hides us in a tapestry of light, oh, we are stars, blankets of wonder. Sky bright eyes seeing the invisible, visible. You who have returned, you have turned our faces so that we see ourselves, and we have found you again in places we would have never imagined. You make our limits infinitely long. Our vision is clearer with eyes closed, and even there, you still stand in full color, vibrant and eager to serve.
That was Suni Patterson, Ancestors. Former political prisoner and lifelong revolutionary Dr. Mutulu Shakur transitioned on July 7th, 2023. Journalist and political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal shares words in honor of Dr. Shakur and in commentary recorded by Prison Radio.
Dr. Mutulu Shakur, presente. His name was Mutulu Shakur. Dr. Mutulu Shakur, a lifetime freedom fighter for black people for most of his life. Born in Baltimore, Maryland as Gerald Wayne Williams on August 8, 1950. His mother moved north when he was 7 years old, and he grew up in New York's Jamaica, Queens. In his 20s, he joined almost every Black liberation movement he encountered. He was a member of the group RAM, for the Revolutionary Action Movement. He worked with Provisional Government of the Republic of New Africa, which sought the establishment of a free Black nation in five southern states. He joined the Black Panther Party and later its military wing, the Black Liberation Army. His service to the Black community wasn't just in revolutionary activism, but as a doctor of acupuncture, where he treated addicted drug users and AIDS patients. He helped found BANA, the Black Acupuncture Advisory Association of North America, and later the Harlem Institute of Acupuncture. In 1975, he married Afeni Shakur, the mother of a little boy named Tupac Amaru Shakur. A daughter, Sekia, was born to the couple. After almost 40 years in prison, charged with the 1981 armed robbery of a Brinks truck and his alleged role in the liberation of BLA soldier, Mutulu was granted compassionate release in December 2022 after an aggressive form of cancer was detected. Dr. Mutulu Shakur returned to his ancestors on July 6, 2023. He is survived by his children, Mohrim, Sekria, Talib, Nzinga, Ayiza, and Kinwa Shakur. Dr. Mutulu Shakur lived through 72 winters. With love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Sean Roland Kirk from the LP Volunteer Slavery, Spirits Up Above, recorded in 1969, Atlantic Records. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program is co-produced and edited by Paulina Vasiliev. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, CapitalismRaceAndDemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on Twitter at PacificaCRD. I'm Akua Holt. I've been your host and co-executive producer, as well as music curator. Thanks for listening. Before we go, I leave you with this quote. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. The Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey.